Azel said, staring through a window at Isaac's hot tub. Why had Isaac confided to Jane about Alex, but not to her and Gregory? Then she remembered the letter, and the fact that much of her grandfather's life had clearly been kept from her. What was one more secret?
Ordinary, her aunt laughed. Alex was a prodigy like his mother, won a fellowship to study at the Max Planck Institute in Bonn, but dropped out after an Autobahn accident. There was some cerebral cortex damage, but Paige wasn't all that sympathetic. Claims he used the accident as an excuse to give up on mathematics entirely. Maybe it broke Paige's heart. What little she has.
So what's he doing now? Gregory asked.
Freelance photographer out of Europe, apparently. For travel magazines and the AP. He was living in Paris for a while. Paige doesn't think he's making much of a living, though. I'm not sure how she'd know. Did you notice they weren't even sitting together this morning? I haven't seen them interact once.
Where's he staying?
Jane shrugged.
I told him he could stay with us, but he says he has a friend in town. A girlfriend, maybe, who knows?
Gregory must have made a face because Jane said,
Oh, don't look so surprised. I've seen pictures of him, and he really is a good-looking man. Underneath all that hair. Wouldn't you say so, Hazel?
Hazel nodded in agreement as she continued to stare at Isaac's hot tub. Dark and covered. Dusted with droppings from a pepper tree. Beyond it, a gibbous moon was rising from the leaves of a date palm. As her aunt chattered on, Hazel rinsed out her glass at the sink and stared out at the pale blue satellite. It had never seemed so frightening and beautiful as it did to her now. Knowing that only several nights before, Isaac had looked out his study window at a sliver of this same moon as he composed the last words anyone would ever receive from him.
Chapter 4. The Policeman. An accident on the shoulder of the freeway made Gregory think of Isaac. He might have pulled his Honda Civic over to see if his assistance was needed, but the strobes told him that plenty of police had already arrived. So he continued on, preserving the sensitive momentum of the interstate. Isaac would have approved. At one time, it had been his grandfather's quest to return Southern California to its streetcar paradise. Isaac hadn't necessarily wanted to rid the road of cars. Let's be sensible. He had simply wanted to make car culture more efficient. He had even wrangled some public funding before the city council decided that drought and the homeless were more pressing issues. But during that brief window, when he and the city had held hands and gazed into a bottleneck-free future, Isaac was quoted in the Los Angeles Times as saying, "What's the use of mathematicians if we can't solve the gigantic math problem staring us in the face every time we drive to work? Traffic is a car dilemma, yes, but it is also a mathematical one." With the accident receding in his rearview mirror, Gregory looked to his left across the median. If he had kept his original engagement tonight instead of going home, he would be shuttling along the opposite side of the freeway about now. But he had reluctantly canceled. It was with a woman he very much wanted to see, but there were limits to his duplicity. Besides, his sister was coming over for dinner. He felt compelled to make up for his bad brothering of late, as in his complete inability to return a simple phone call or text. Just because he could barely manage his own life, that was no excuse for neglecting his only real blood connection. Maybe they could take this opportunity to become close again, as they had been when they were young. Hazel and Gregory together again, or Hansel and Gretel, as they'd been called in their school days. A taunt that had mysteriously followed them no matter how many times they changed homes or schools. They could have a laugh about that tonight. He wasn't looking forward to the news he had to give Hazel. He had considered not telling her at all and sparing her the anxiety, but one of the family was bound to let it slip. Assuming they, too, had gotten their notices from the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Gregory's attention was diverted by the sight of a girl, 7 years old maybe, seated in a sedan one lane over. She had clearly been crying, which triggered in him an involuntary mix of compassion and fury.
He couldn't stand the sight of a sad child, so much so that he had turned his entire career at the LAPD into rescuing them. Now that he was a father, the intensity of his reaction to seeing unhappy children was almost unbearable. While most new parents became myopic in their fixation with their own offspring, for Gregory, it was as if every child was his own. He looked back at the girl, whose resemblance to his sister at that age, unbrushed hair, wide-set eyes, was startling. Something about the way she stared, toy gripped to chest. Gregory would tell his sister the news tonight. He would wait until his wife had gone to bed, then put on a pot for tea. Hayes?
Yeah?
She would look up from her mug, a flicker of concern passing over her face. I have something to tell you. There were so many things he could tell her. But for tonight, he would stick to just one. He's out of prison.
What?
He's out.
I don't believe you.
Yes, well. After a lengthy explanation, he would try to persuade her not to worry. But Gregory himself was having a difficult time ignoring the secret dread that had been compressing his insides like a C-clamp. Aside from Hazel, Isaac was the only one who would have understood his current apprehension. But now he was gone. No matter how much Gregory tried to tell himself it would all be fine, he didn't quite believe it. And he wanted to, if only for this evening. About a mile from home, Gregory realized he was being followed. But when he identified the car's retro headlights as those of a 2005 Ford Thunderbird convertible, he relaxed. There was only one person he knew who drove that car. Fritz Dornbach, Isaac's accountant of nearly 15 years. Because of Fritz's additional law degree, he also did some legal work for the family. But his main purpose had been to shield Isaac from having anything to do with bookkeeping, banks, or money, a role in which Fritz seemed to take particular pride. One could almost see him boasting at the annual CPA conference about his genius client. Sure, he may be close to solving Goldbach's conjecture or whatever, but swear to God, so much as show him his own checkbook, and he's out in the barn frantically petting rabbits. But Isaac's distaste for money management had nothing to do with ineptitude. Finance isn't math, Gregory's grandfather liked to say. It's number enslavement. The convertible overtook him, and by the time Gregory pulled into his driveway, his diminutive pursuer was standing in front of the house, his peppery hair comically windblown. Fritz had on his optical illusion shoes, the ones designed to boost height while obscuring where his actual feet were resting. It wasn't much of an illusion.
I called, Fritz said. Maybe you couldn't hear the ringing coming from your purse.
Gregory wasn't in the mood for banter.
What's up, Fritz?
From behind his back, Fritz produced a folder, decorated with an illustration of a monarch butterfly.
My assistant picked out the folder, he mumbled.
Am I supposed to know what this is?
But Gregory had some idea. Just days after Isaac's death, Fritz had left a lengthy message on his voicemail.
Why is everyone, including your friends at the LAPD, acting as if a perfectly happy guy electrocuting himself is normal? I mean, before he's even finished breakfast? A breakfast with two place settings, I might add?
But had his grandfather really been happy? With his work stalled. He hadn't published anything serious in years. And the love of his life in a home for the senile, that was debatable. As for the extra place setting, this had been explained away by the housekeeper, who said that Isaac often made an extra breakfast for her on the mornings she stopped by. Fritz held out the folder.
It's the bank records I was telling you about. Steady cash withdrawals at the end of each month for the last 5.5 years. Not a ton, but not exactly pocket money.
I don't see how it's my business.
You're the detective. At least have a look. I drove all the way over here.
Gregory relented and took the folder.
You never asked him about it?
Once or twice, but all he said was that he liked cash. I teased him about slowly stashing a fortune away in that rat's nest house of his, but then I forgot about it.
Fritz turned in the direction of Pico Boulevard, where a car horn had started wailing.
He never did fix that gridlock thing, did he?
Gridlock isn't real mathematics. Or that's what he said when he lost his funding.
Fritz moved to his car.
You know what he told me once? That the whole universe is one giant computer, and every second it's calculating its own future down to the last detail, right down to some guy getting angry on the road.
Gregory nodded.
He did like a good metaphor. Join us for dinner?
Fritz had become something of a family friend over the years, but this was less an invite than an end to the conversation.
Can't. I've got a date. But I'm having a little masquerade in Hollywood this weekend, if you and Goldie are up for it.
Not sure I can handle one of your parties, Fritz. We're taking Louis trick-or-treating.
Right. Another time, then?
Gregory watched the accountant maneuver himself back into the driver's seat of his Thunderbird. It wasn't unlike watching a child clamber onto a chair. And for some reason, the image made him sad, and he turned away. After putting his son to bed, Gregory sat down to a late dinner with his wife and sister. Though he had seen Hazel the previous Christmas, it felt as if it had been much longer. She looked healthy, but older. Cheeks not quite as round. Eyes not quite as hope-filled. But then again, he knew his own face was looking increasingly excavated. On account of their guest, Goldie had made a dinner featuring several complicated courses. In addition to putting in extra time in the kitchen, she had also put some effort into her appearance. Her brassy curls were pulled up from her neck, her lips painted coral, and her cheeks dusted with bronzer. His wife wasn't pretty exactly, but she did her best to highlight her assets.
"Such a beautiful service,"
Goldie said halfway through dinner, a phrase she had uttered at least 10 times since yesterday.
"Wasn't it beautiful?"
Hazel, who had stayed mostly quiet since her arrival, mumbled in agreement. She seemed unusually distant, though Gregory knew the same could be said of him. As his wife chattered on about the funeral, he imagined letting the news fall right there at the table, followed by Hazel's disbelief.
"But it was a life sentence."
"He was well-behaved."
A pause as she considered recent events.
"The timing is weird, isn't it?"
"Maybe, but you know what Isaac would say. Concurrence of events and all that, it doesn't mean..."
"Did Isaac know he was out?"
"We didn't have much of a chance to talk about it."
"Daddy!"
Gregory's interior stage play was interrupted by his 2-year-old son, who had tottered into the room grasping a rubber fish Hazel had brought him as a present. As Louis began to explore the tail with his mouth, Gregory made a mental note to check the toxicity of the material. He pushed back his chair. "I'll put him down." He took up Louis in one affectionate swoop and, planting kisses all the way down the hall, went to deliver the second bedtime story of the night. When the dishes were cleared and his wife had turned in, Gregory put a kettle on and sat Hazel down in the kitchen. In the event she didn't believe him, he was ready to produce his letters from the Department of Corrections. But Hazel looked tired and distracted, and was rapidly losing her ability to engage as the evening wore on. She would be calling it a night soon, going back to the house to enjoy the comforts of her old bedroom. He was certain that plying her with hot chocolate would do the trick, but when he handed her a mug with the name of her store, the Gutter Snipe, printed along the rim, she seemed to crumple.
"What?"
"Nothing."
She got up, surprising him by grabbing some Captain Morgan from a shelf. She wasn't a big drinker, but gave both their mugs a liberal splash. As Gregory looked down and watched the cool rum disrupt the harmony of milk and chocolate, he imagined the liquor, milk, and cocoa particles following a dispersion equation of their own making. It had been years since he'd studied fluid dynamics in school, but moving gas and liquid still had the power to command his attention. To this day, he stared entirely too long at the whorls escaping a smoker's lips, or a stray seed pod gliding along the surface of a pool. He took a sip of the spiked hot chocolate, and waited for Hazel to look up. Although he'd long ago lost the ability to read her moods, he could see that something was wrong, beyond the loss of their grandfather.
You all right?
She shrugged.
Just the usual self-evaluation that happens when one of the few people you care about dies, and the other one has lost her mind.
Tell her now. But before he could form the words, she was wiping away tears with the back of her hand.
Did I tell you I lost my apartment last month?
She said.
You didn't mention that, no.
He tried to maintain a calm expression.
Did I mention that I'm so embarrassed about it that I haven't even told my boyfriend? My very successful boyfriend who wouldn't at all secretly judge me.
Jesus, Hayes. Where are you living?
In a charming cupboard in the back of my store.
At the thought of his sister trapped in a tiny dark space, Gregory felt a dizzy spell coming on. Or maybe he was just tired. He put both palms flat on the table and took a deep breath. A grounding technique he had used when they were young, whenever it felt like their wobbly little world might spin off its axis. Hazel reached over and touched his arm. He forced a smile.
Well, it all sounds very cozy, Hayes.
Oh, it is. So cozy, it's slowly killing me.
She took a hard swallow from her mug.
I guess I could close the shop. Get a job like you hear about. But the thought of spending the rest of my life being harassed by some boss and surrounded by those fluorescent lights and awful ceiling tiles, you know, the ones, she caught herself. Sorry.
No, I like depressing lighting and bad ceilings. I actually prefer it.
She started to laugh, but her eyes didn't follow, and soon she was crying harder than before. He wished he could say something to make her smile, as he'd been able to do when they were small. She would have been curled up on a twin mattress, sad face pressed to her teddy bear Cedric, an oddly posh name given their surroundings. Though Gregory, now 33, was barely 2 years older, he had once taken on his role as big brother with gravity, always hunting for new ways to protect and comfort her. In the absence of Kleenex, he offered her a stack of napkins.
You know, you can come live with us. I mean it.
I appreciate it, but...
She took a napkin and pressed it to her eyes.
What the hell am I going to do?
Have you thought about going back to school?
She groaned.
Why does everyone ask me that like I'm some illiterate dropout?
What did Isaac say about all this?
Hazel looked away.
He only would have tried to give me money, and I know he didn't have any. All of it went into the house and taking care of Lily.
Talk of Isaac's money made Gregory think of Fritz's butterfly folder. By the time they reached the silt at the bottom of their mugs, he knew he wasn't going to be telling his sister about Tom. Because if he told her that on top of everything else, their former foster father was out of prison, she might have a mental collapse right there at the table. The news would have to wait until he could do something about Tom. Something concrete. Or at least until Hazel was back in Seattle. Far from the man who could once again infect both of their lives.
Chapter 5. The Letter. At almost 2 in the morning, back in Beechwood Canyon, Hazel awoke from a nightmare. Something about the bay engulfing Pioneer Square and her shop floating out to Puget Sound. As she lay in the dark of her old room, with the lingering image of herself marooned on a slab of shelving, she wondered why her dream symbology had always been so irritatingly obvious. Yes, her store was underwater. Got it. Why couldn't she have coded, indecipherable dreams like most people? Yet behind all the unambiguous imagery, there had been something lurking. Isaac's letter.
Hazel had read the letter countless times that day and felt just as helpless and confused as the first time. She had almost told Gregory about it after dinner, tempted by what felt like a precious fleeting moment of brother-sister camaraderie. Instead, she'd offered up a list of substitute miseries, all completely valid and certainly responsible for her stress levels, but not the real reason she had totally lost it at her brother's kitchen table. It was an unusually blustery night. The house creaked and moaned under the strain of the wind. A stiff palm frond fingernailed its way back and forth across a window. She'd forgotten how spooky the house could be after dark, but felt comforted at least that Sybil, Jack, and their daughter were sleeping downstairs. They had intended to stay with Philip and Jane in Pasadena before flying back home to the Bay Area, but had returned to the canyon after Sybil quarreled with her parents. Hazel had gathered little about it other than what Jack had whispered to her. "Not easy being the offspring of a genius, you know." Hazel let her gaze fall across the room, where a shaft of moonlight illuminated the spines of her mystery novels, one of which concealed Isaac's letter. Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Gladys Mitchell, to name a few. They were all books she had read greedily as a child, but whose plots later congealed into a single generic mass. Once in a while, a certain character or revelatory moment would float back to her, but she could rarely remember which book or author. Now a fragment of something seemed to be calling to Hazel from the shelf. Something to do with the murder of a paperback writer. She got out of bed and threw on a pilled robe. She remembered the story now, or at least the end. The entire solution hinged on a single clue left on the ribbon of a typewriter. When the hero detective unwound the spool, he found the final thoughts of the victim, including the identity of his killer, left in the negative imprint of inked ribbon. "My killer is..." The story, though not terribly sophisticated, had ignited her young imagination. And now, thinking of Isaac's typewriter, she couldn't get to his study fast enough. She slipped out of the bedroom and made her way down the hall, careful to avoid the rickety floorboard. The house was still, and the only sound came from a chronically leaky bathtub faucet. Ta-ta-ta-ta. The drips pounded the porcelain with the discipline of a drum machine, and it seemed that even in this tedious sound, her grandfather was present. Many years ago, Isaac had sat in the kitchen with her and Gregory, lip-syncing to the rhythm of an intensely weepy kitchen faucet with uncanny precision. Tat-a-tat-tat-o-tat, a-tat-tat-o-tat-tat. While she and her brother giggled uncontrollably, delighted by his ability to inhabit the spirit of the tap. "See, the drips only appear random," he told them after their laughter subsided. "But if you listen carefully, you can pick out the pattern." And with a pen, as if jotting off Morse code, Isaac marked out the dots and dashes of the chaotic system, which he explained was not chaotic at all, for chaos theory had been clumsily named. Short drip, long, short, silence. One could alter the system, making it more or less complex by loosening or tightening the handle. "And you know," he continued, "bad plumbing isn't the only thing that drips. The entire world drips, too. And if you pay very close attention, you can anticipate the next drop." Everything, of course, had been a game to her grandfather, and Hazel had to ask herself, was he playing a game with her now? The study was as she'd last seen it. All dark wood and heavy books. An egghead's sanctum. She rolled aside his chair, ducked beneath the massive desk, and lifted Isaac's ancient IBM from its home on the floor. A gentle tug of the cord revealed that it hadn't been unplugged since its last use. She lifted the case and took out the ink cartridge, holding it to the desk lamp. She slowly pulled the ribbon loose like dental floss, but there were no fossilized letters in the ink, only shiny new ribbon. The cartridge had been replaced. She tipped the garbage can with her foot. Empty. So, that was that. As Hazel attempted to re-spool the ribbon, she heard a noise. After a pause, she heard it again. The floorboard outside. On instinct, she stood up and yanked the typewriter onto the chair, letting the ribbon fall to the floor. She rolled the chair under the desk and turned to the nearest bookshelf, pretending to examine the titles. The door opened, and Sybil, in a girlish nightgown that just brushed her knees, stepped into the dim light.
"Oh," Hazel said, trying to appear cool. "Did I wake you?"
Her cousin said nothing, just gazed sleepily in her direction. She noticed, not without passing envy, that Sybil was just as radiant at 2 o'clock in the morning as she had been earlier that day. Hazel also gathered that she was, in fact, asleep. She had never witnessed one of her cousin's sleepwalking episodes, though she had heard all the stories, the most repeated one involving Sybil's wandering out of a Park Avenue hotel on her honeymoon, hailing a taxi, and a frantic Jack having to flag down his own cab and chase his silk-pajamaed wife all the way to LaGuardia Airport. There was an undeniable level-headedness to Sybil's nighttime adventures. She always put on shoes before stepping outside, and she had the uncanny ability to sleep navigate. Just as Hazel considered waking her cousin, Sybil fell against the doorframe and muttered,
No, I told you already.
She let out a long whine and slid to the floor, where she began to quietly cry. Hazel was about to prod her awake when the hall light came on, and Jack shuffled into view. He had a dark, brooding face, superficially similar to the men Hazel tended to like, Bennett included.
"There you are,"
he said, sliding an arm around the weeping Sybil.
"Sorry about this, Hazel."
"Should we wake her?"
"Better not."
He pulled Sybil to her feet. Hazel thought he looked remarkably unrattled given his wife's distress. Nor did he appear in the least bit curious about what Hazel was doing up this time of night.
"Back to bed, darling."
As Hazel watched the pair move toward the stairs, she wondered if her cousin was really the upbeat wife and mother she appeared to be in her waking hours. When she could no longer hear the creaking stairs or the sobs, she closed the door and set the typewriter back on the desk. After re-spooling the ribbon and clicking it back into place, she was overcome with the need to write something. She rolled a piece of paper into the drum and began to peck at the keys, as if searching for a new form of communication with the dead. "Dear Isaac,
are you sure you are of sound mind?
Have to ask. How am I supposed to help you when you haven't told me where to look? Room 137? Not helpful. This isn't exactly a, by the way, can you water my plants now that I'm dead, type of favor. I am broke and have a business that is failing. Tomorrow I'm going to have lunch with my brother and then I'm going to get on a plane and resume my life. What else can I do? I hope you'll forgive me. Miss you awfully. Hayes. P.S. You can't expect me to destroy the letter. It is the last thing I have from you, and I just can't do it." As she was typing this appeal, Hazel noticed something. Or rather, she noticed the absence of something. The keys weren't sticking. The metallic ball stamped away without stutters. How then had Isaac's letter been riddled with the typewriter's habitual ticks? She inspected the casing and found his initials, IDS, scratched into the blue plastic. It certainly was his machine. Had he gotten the thing repaired after he'd typed the letter? She slid open his desk drawers one by one, hoping to find she didn't know what. A receipt for typewriter repair? She found only mechanical pencils, notebooks of equations, and folders filled with clippings from the obituary pages, a lifelong obsession of his. Finally, giving up, she pulled her impromptu letter from the roller. She was not a detective, she told herself, and this was not a whodunit. Yet in a final move of genre-inspired panic, Hazel dropped the page and, snip snip, its corresponding piece of ribbon into the trash bin, and set a match to it. After the flame swelled and died, she doused the ashes with water from a spider plant and tossed the mess out the window. It was the same window, she noted, that Isaac had mentioned in his letter. Seeing her sleuthing to the end, she pulled out her phone and, after a few clicks, pulled up a lunar calendar. Yes, it had indeed been a setting crescent moon the evening of October 15th, the night before he posted his letter, 2 days before his death. As she looked up at the now dark patch of sky, a string of words began to gather in her mind, where they arranged themselves into yet another puzzling question. Why go 20-some years without fixing your typewriter, only to get it repaired the day before you die? Chapter 6. The University. On the Monday morning following his father's burial, Philip arrived at his office in the Charles C. Lauritsen Laboratory of High Energy Physics to find two things attached to his door. The first was a stiff envelope sticking out of the jamb at neck level, as if poised for a tracheal paper cut. In neat pen it said, "Please read, your father." Philip pulled it from its crevice. There was no return address, only a strange design in the corner, a tiny spiral with a tail extending downward, like a disembodied brain. He folded the envelope and slipped it into his jacket pocket in exchange for his keys. The second item was a flyer taped to the door's frosted glass, featuring a photo of himself staring into the camera with a look of mild digestive discomfort. Right below, a bouncy font announced the talk he would be giving later that week, entitled, "New Non-Perturbative Results for Non-BPS Black Hole M-Brain Constructions in M-Theory." The lecture was part of a series of dry-run talks to be given in preparation for the International Conference on Particle Physics at the CERN Laboratory in Switzerland in the new year. While standing above the world's largest particle accelerator, men and women like Philip could reveal the brilliant math they had been forging behind closed doors. Mathematical physics, attempting to answer the only question he and his colleagues found worth asking, the question that had eluded even Einstein. How do we unify the four forces of the universe into one law? But at that moment, standing in front of his Caltech office of 25 years, looking at a photo of his visibly younger self, Philip didn't feel in a position to be answering questions about anything, let alone the nature of the universe. He squinted to read the small print at the bottom of the flyer, which told him that his lecture was that Wednesday at 5:15. Yes, right. He would have to scramble to prepare something now, something that didn't make his research sound as if it had completely stalled. A conversation with his father would have helped spur him on. And the realization that he would never discuss anything with him again, would never pop into his father's old office in the Sloan Laboratory of Mathematics and Physics, just two buildings over, made him feel unbearably old. Philip unlocked the door and, avoiding a pile of sympathy letters at his feet, stepped to the window for some air. He cranked open the fourth-story casement to reveal yet another cloudless day in paradise, the sun doggedly illuminating every speck of campus, every leaf on every olive tree. Philip had never quit marveling at how much intellectual power inhabited this 124-acre patch of Southern California. How anyone managed to ignore the swaying palms and raging light outside their windows, long enough to have a single intelligent thought, still mystified him. Give him a gloomy country, England, Sweden, Russia, and he'd show you a nation of busy scientists. Give him a balmy paradise, and he'd point to people finding every reason not to do theoretical physics. Caltech seemed to be the exception. Rescuing the envelopes from the floor, he tore into each with a letter opener Jane had given him many years ago as a tenure gift. Ever the sentimentalist, she had had the knife inscribed with a small heart close to the blade, and Philip now found his thumb exploring the heart's delicate ridges and the sweet, if obvious, inscription. You are my constant. He paused for a moment to take in a pair of official-looking goldenrod envelopes. Their strident color and government seals insisted that they be opened immediately. But there was a limit to the information he could take in right now. Philip opened a side drawer and dropped them inside. Sifting through the sympathy cards, his eyes passed over the words, irreplaceable and adored, and over names he knew well and those he recognized only dimly. But the words and phrases were just vacant syllables, incapable of conveying the true nature of any person, let alone his father. He has left a great blah blah. If there's anything I can blah. He will be truly shut the hell up. Never have I met a more seriously fuck off. Philip was trying to decide what to do with the letters when he remembered the envelope in his pocket. He pulled it out and stared at the spiraled brain again. The symbol suddenly seemed familiar. But from where? He was about to pick up the knife again when Anit Kadurov, a fourth-year grad student from Ukraine, appeared at his door. He didn't have to turn to know she was standing there. Her voice was unmistakable. After however many years of living in the United States, she showed no signs of giving up her thick accent.
Professor Severi, I wanted to say I'm very sorry for your loss, she said with a peculiar flatness, as if she were holding a tourist's phrasebook just out of sight.
Thank you, he managed.
I was sorry we didn't get to talk at the service.
I didn't realize you were there, he said, glancing up. She smiled.
I met your father once. He was an incredible man.
That he was.
His exploratory work on highway systems was quite brilliant.
He started to clear a space in his desk for the letters as she continued.
This idea that traffic is a single predictable organism rather than a bunch of separate objects.
He threw her an impatient look.
If you'll excuse me, Anitka. It's a bad time?
They do make me teach once in a while.
Sure, I get it.
She pivoted theatrically out of the room. But as he gathered his material for the lecture, Philip could sense her lingering outside the door, waiting to ensnare him the instant he crossed the threshold. Anit Kadurov was the last person he wanted to see at the moment. And not just because she had the strange power to unnerve him. She had become a departmental pest, an unpopular doctoral candidate who, after having completely rejected her original course of study, was now desperately hunting for a dissertation advisor. Her original advisor, Kimiko Kato, one of the top string theorists in the world, had emphatically refused to work with her, female solidarity aside. And now Philip had become Anitka's prime target, despite the fact that her intended thesis was in polar opposition to everything he stood for. She had formed a deep attachment to him after he had come to her rescue the previous spring, in what became known across campus and the physics blogosphere as the Durov Affair. Anitka Durov had, against all odds, pulled off one of the most improbable hoaxes in the history of scientific journals, when she submitted a phony, pseudonymous paper on an underexplored question in string theory to the European Review of Theoretical Physics. When the prank was discovered, as she had taken no real pains to hide its true authorship, apart from a fake author website easily traceable to her IP address, Anitka was promptly suspended. She fought the suspension aggressively, arguing that there had been a noble twofold purpose to her hoax. First, to expose the flaws in the editorial review process of physics journals. And second, to humorously demonstrate, though none found it funny, the lack of scientific rigor in the string theory community at large. How was it, she asked, that after 2 weeks only one reader had noticed anything wrong with her half-nonsensical paper? It would have been one thing, the department felt, if she had simply submitted her paper to the online archive, where it could have been deleted or ignored. But to commit fraud to actual paper in a real archival journal was inexcusable. Yet Philip knew that the faculty's indignation had little to do with serious scientific fraud, as the members so condemned it. The truth was far more personal. In nearly any other circumstance, they would have applauded the entire confidence trick, smugly congratulating themselves for being in on the joke. Anitka's name would have been bandied about at parties, praised at the blackboard, and waggishly cited in academic papers. But because she had lampooned the work of many distinguished theorists, going so far as to copy and paste verbatim from their papers to create a kind of humiliating pastiche, the targeted faculty were less inclined to find her stunt cute or admirable. Philip was the only professor to come to Anitka's defense, calling her demonstration reckless and stupid, but ultimately carried out in the spirit of academic risk-taking. After a few months of suspension and a warning from the department, Ms. Durov was permitted to continue her studies. But Anitka's reputation had been blighted by the whole episode, and now, as she was homing in on Philip as an advisor, he was regretting his former heroics. He stepped into the hallway.
"Maybe we could talk later," Anitka suggested as he headed off to class.
"Why don't we catch up over email?
Or over a drink?"
"Look, I don't mean to be pushy," she said, "but I need your thoughts on my dissertation."
"You've changed topics, then?"
"You know I haven't." His chest rose and fell.
"As I've said before, you'd be better served finding someone else. At this point, someone outside the school who might be of actual help to you."
"I'd like your opinion on some new ideas, is all.
No strings."
She swallowed the pun. He was only half listening as he locked up his office.
"Well, I can't talk before Friday."
After a small nod, he retreated down the hallway, expecting her to call after him, as was her habit. When she didn't, Philip turned around and was surprised to see her marching in the opposite direction. He watched her for a moment, his eyes involuntarily straying to the curve of the hip as she turned into the stairwell. He looked away, feeling a stitch of guilt as he realized how brusque he'd been with her. But how else to rid himself of a pest? He checked his watch. In his rush to flee Anitka, he had given himself excess time to make it to class, which didn't start for another 10 minutes. Philip ducked into the faculty lounge. Not being in the mood for departmental chit-chat, he was pleased to find the kitchen deserted. But as he crossed the room, he noticed a colleague sitting at a corner table, nose to the wood grain, pencil scribbling. It was only Andrei Kuchek, and chit-chat-wise, he was harmless. For as long as Philip had known Kuchek, as many papers as they had co-authored as members of the department's string theory group, Philip was still made to feel like a stranger whenever he walked into a room where his friend was working. Kuchek was the classic specimen of a nearsighted, socially challenged academic, a man who devoured his work whole and avoided speaking to anyone unless absolutely necessary. For this, he was mercilessly, though affectionately, teased. Kuchek's own students routinely called him the Asp, or Professor Aspie, which Philip had initially assumed was some unkind allusion to Kuchek's lean, snake-like appearance. Only later did someone inform him that ASP was short for Asperger's, a syndrome for which Kuchek seemed a strong candidate.
"Morning, Andre."
No reply. Typical. It was the little game the two of them played, though Philip could never be sure that it wasn't entirely one-sided.
"Good to see you at the service, Andre. Really, it meant a lot."
Nothing.
"How's the coffee this morning?"
"What's that you say? Extraordinary?" He was filling his mug with steamless coffee when he realized he was still holding the brain spiral envelope in his other hand. He set down the coffee pot and, with a butter knife from the rack, slit open the envelope. On a single rectangle of white cardstock, in tidy penmanship it read, "So sorry to hear of your father's passing. A truly monumental loss. I had been in touch with him regarding his recent research. Please call. Whenever is convenient for you, naturally. P. Booth Lyons, Government Scholar Relations, GSR. There was a phone number at the bottom, 703 area code. Wasn't that Virginia? P. Booth Lyons. Philip stared at the card for a long minute before he realized he had been holding his breath. Why the hell was P. Booth Lyons contacting him? His father had playfully referred to him as either Phone Booth or That Spook, because Lyons had been borderline harassing Isaac for years, dating back to his retirement. But it was all through letters, emails, and persistent voice messages from his secretary, which led Philip to believe that he was probably harmless. Though there had been one night, after Isaac found a note on his front door, that's why the brain spiral seemed familiar, that Philip had briefly considered getting a restraining order so that his father might live out his emeritus years in peace. The last time the subject had come up had been over a father-son lunch at the faculty dining hall, during which Philip had started to wonder about his father's mental stability.
"Mr. Phone Booth is starting up again," his father had said over a chicken salad. "If I want to start my career as a mathematical spy, I guess now's my chance."
"Right.
I'd kind of like to know what this government scholar business is while I'm still alive. Should we go meet him?" "I don't know, Dad. What happened the last time a bunch of mathematicians and physicists got together to help the government? Oh, right. Somewhere in Asia, 250,000 people died because their skin melted off." "Yes, yes, but how do we know that the government in Government Scholar is the U.S.?" He's never actually specified which government we're talking about. "A con man hazy on specifics, huh? The man is harassing you. Let's not indulge him." A frown from his father. "Have you always been this way? So staid and unadventurous?" Isaac was not generally a vicious man, but he continued. "I think this tranquilized attitude of yours is enfeebling your mind and your work. I keep up with everything you're doing, Philip, and frankly..."
In that second, he wished his father really were battling senility, because that would hurt less than the alternative.
"Dad, stop with the dramatics, please. We're allowed to have fallow periods, as you well know."
Isaac Severy famously didn't have fallow periods. Yet Philip watched his face for a sign that he had hit the mark. It had been years since his father shared what he was working on. Philip had stolen early glances at his father's traffic equation, but when pressed on it, Isaac would evade all inquiry, saying only that the mathematics wasn't ready. This time, Isaac had looked away, avoiding his son's eyes for the rest of the meal.
"If you're not careful, Philip, you'll have brain rot. Just like your brother."
It was then that Philip had started to suspect that his father's latest work, whatever it was only a mirage. He abandoned the unpleasant memory and took one more gulp of coffee before leaving the faculty lounge.
"Yeah, see you around," he told Kuchek.
Philip took a final glance at the note. I had been in touch with him regarding his recent research. Oh, really? And what research would that be? The topology of the geriatric brain? The calculus of killing yourself in a whirlpool bath? Philip flirted with the idea of calling the 703 number.
"Hello, Mr. Lyons. Yes, I'm familiar with my father's work, and I find it unlikely that it would be of use to anyone, let alone government scholars and their relations. Goodbye."
Still, a worm of curiosity had worked its way into his brain. And Philip wondered if his father had really been serious about contacting this man. And if so, why? He made a mental note to check his father's study for anything unusual, and his old campus office while he was at it. Then he slipped the card in his pocket, put on his best advanced topics in supersymmetry face, and made his way to the lecture hall. Chapter 7 Headquarters. Hazel had been sitting on the steps outside LAPD headquarters for 20 minutes when she heard someone laughing. She turned to find Detective E.J. Kenley standing behind her, the woman's trim figure framed in the entryway.
"You homeless now, or did your brother stand you up?"
Hazel smiled, stood to greet the towering detective, and was pulled into a vigorous embrace.
"We're supposed to be getting lunch at Langer's," Hazel said. "It's the only place that doesn't make him gag."
"Right. What's that thing he likes to say?" I'll eat when I'm dead?
Dumbest thing I've ever heard, EJ said, laughing again. He's out on a case, but you're welcome to loiter upstairs.
Hazel followed the detective through security, where she flashed a badge that read MYP in large letters. Minority Youth in Peril was EJ's pet project. Years ago, she had gotten fed up seeing her little brothers and sisters disappear quietly into the shadows, while the clockwork of the media snapped into atomic precision any time a blonde girl from the suburbs vanished. "Want to get away with kidnapping?" EJ had once asked in a letter to the Los Angeles Times. "Snatch up a black kid from the Jordan Downs projects and watch the ice flow reflexes of the press. But so much as touch a toe-headed girl in Utah, and the entire world yanks out its hair in collective anguish." The elevator opened onto the third floor, and they started down a modernist corridor flooded with natural light. When Hazel had last visited her brother at work, the building still had been relatively new, smelling of paint and freshly rolled carpet. Now the carpet shone with the steps of countless heels, and the pumpkin-colored walls seemed to belong to another era.
"I was sorry to hear about Isaac," EJ said as the spacious hall gave way to the hive of the main office. "I know he was like a father to you both. You want some coffee? Let's get some coffee."
Hazel trailed her through the belly of the juvenile protection unit, catching glimpses of what her brother had to face every day. What appeared at first to be your average corporate office, everything Hazel had tried to escape in life. Grids of fluorescence, water coolers, inspirational posters, had upon closer inspection a more chilling quality. A desk detective scrubbed through digital footage of a teenage girl curled on a couch sobbing, while an adjacent screen featured a toddler's legs blighted with hash marks.
"Waffle iron," EJ whispered.
"God, you're kidding," Hazel said, her hand instinctively moving to an old scar on the side of her neck. She fingered its long, petal-shaped groove, hardly aware she was doing it. As EJ continued down the hall, Hazel paused at a strip of corkboard lined with pictures of men, young and old. Their eyes all held the same exhaustion, the same depleted look of lives spent by turns fighting and giving in to dark impulse. A few of the photographs had a red masking-taped K covering the face.
"That's how we mark the dead ones," EJ explained. "For karma."
"Karma?"
"Late last year, this scumbag's working on his truck, gets gasoline on his clothes. Later he starts fiddling with a gas water heater and whoosh! The pilot light turns him into a human torch. A neighbor saw everything, but by the time she got her bony ass to the phone, it was all over. Some people here like to call that karma, or the universe having its way. I call it plain spooky."
Hazel didn't want to think about the universe having its way with people, scumbag or not. She didn't want to think of Isaac in that tub with those string lights. EJ ushered her into a break room and poured two mugs of coffee. Hazel took one.
"I don't know how you can, you know,
come to work every day?"
"Yeah."
"You disconnect a little. Make it a scavenger hunt.
You go crazy otherwise."
"And my brother?" EJ laughed for no apparent reason.
"You'll have to ask him."
After a few polite questions about Hazel's life, EJ pointed her toward Gregory's cubicle by the far windows. She then excused herself to resume her search for the missing Jasmines and Jamals of Los Angeles. From her brother's desk, Hazel could see the gleaming spire of City Hall across the street. Mercifully, there was no evidence of distressed children in the immediate area. Just nostalgic prints of L.A. architecture along one wall, including Union Station, its Art Deco interior overlaid with the image of a sleek train. Her brother's desk was austere, save for a small photo of Lewis and a coffee mug featuring a math geek's coy declaration of love. "The square root of -1 is less than 3 mu. It had been Isaac's gift to Gregory at an age when a boy can still be anything, when his brain has not yet run up against its own border checkpoints. Before Hazel knew what she was doing, she began opening his desk drawers. She was snooping, of course, yet her body seemed to know this before she did. It felt like she'd been craving this the entire trip, a moment that might illuminate her brother's increasingly detached behavior. Because God forbid she confront him herself. Most of the desk was locked, except for the center left drawer, which opened to reveal a stack of folders. The folder on top, with its illustration of a butterfly, seemed out of place, like something you'd see in a girl's backpack. When Hazel flipped back the cover, the contents looked deadly boring. Financial printouts of some kind. She shifted her attention to the blue folder below it. Inside was a small stack of long-lens photographs, all of a man with close-cropped white hair and sunglasses. Most of the images showed him walking, waiting at bus stops, or reaching into trash cans. Someone, presumably Gregory, had jotted times and cross streets in the margins. The man seemed familiar, but maybe it was because he reminded her of the men she'd just seen on the wall. How strange her brother's life was, creeping after creeps, stalking the stalkers. She wasn't sure what made her more uncomfortable, the man himself or Gregory's surveillance of him. She closed the folder quickly and slipped it back into place. She was about to do the same with the butterfly folder when she spotted Isaac's name in the corner of a page. On closer inspection, she realized the printouts were her grandfather's bank statements. Highlighted in yellow, at one-month intervals were withdrawals of $2,700 in cash. The statements went on for pages and pages, years back, and every month, the same withdrawal. A sticky note on the second page read, "Let's talk, Fritz." Hazel noticed a Xerox machine a few desks away, but just as she had the thought to dash off some copies, Gregory's voice drifted from down the corridor. She put back the folder and struck a pose at the window, as if she were having one last look at the city before returning home. Her brother seemed annoyed as they headed outside to the parking lot. She made a few comments about EJ, how nice it was to see her again. But he only grunted. "Must be fun being a detective," she almost added, but reminded herself that policing the wheel of abuse that trundled eternally through the generations could hardly be a good time. Then again, from her perspective, sleuthing around L.A. seemed preferable to returning to a demeaning existence up north. And there it was again. The feeling that had been sneaking up on her all day. She didn't want to go home. Or was afraid to. The sense of something left dangerously unfinished nagged at her, as if Isaac's letter might haunt her like a paper ghost. But she had a life to get back to. Bennett had been a bit aloof lately, sure, but if she took a frank look at her own behavior, she was the one putting up emotional blockades. She hadn't even told him she was living in her store. So how could she rely on him if she couldn't even manage a basic level of honesty? They were supposed to be each other's safe house. But she wondered if, in their 22 months together, that had ever materialized in any real way. Even her bookstore wasn't the sanctuary it had once been. So, if not her store, or her boyfriend, then what was she going back for? "Stop it," she told herself. "You can't abandon your life because it's hard. Make it work, love your boyfriend, save your business. Buck the hell up." As they climbed into Gregory's Honda, Hazel idly wondered if she should install a camping shower in the bookstore bathroom. She'd be digging through trash cans next, like that sad man. And those bank statements. She could certainly use $2,700 a month herself. She felt slightly guilty for having snooped, but if the statements were important enough for Fritz to make copies, why hadn't Gregory let her in on it? When they were turning onto the freeway for the airport, Gregory cleared his throat.
"I guess I screwed up lunch, huh?"
She nodded. "Say goodbye to cream sodas and hot pastrami on rye." The invocation of a Langer's deli sandwich, the best in the city, did nothing for her food-indifferent brother. She changed the subject and asked him about work, but all she got out of him was,
"There's a lot of field stuff lately. It's good to get out of the office."
She gave him a sideways glance, wanting more than ever to tell him about the letter, to bring him into the fold.
"Remember Isaac's typewriter?"
she blurted. Gregory was focused on making the next exit.
"Of course."
"The one with the sticky keys?"
"Sure, not that it ever stopped."